So, hello again and welcome to another episode of Quick Question with Soren and Daniel. We've been told that we need to say something up top informing listeners that this is a new episode, so this is me telling you. This one is... Quick Question is where two best friends who happen to be TV writers separated by 3,000 miles created a podcast to catch up and ask each other non-pressing questions because it seemed easier than making new friends. I am one half of this podcast. My name is Daniel O'Brien. Hello. And I am joined, as always, by the second half of this podcast, Soren Bowie.
Hello. Go. I'm Soren Bowie. Dan, I'm loving the new couch bit.
Yeah?
Yeah. Is it going to be the exact same wording every single time?
There was a subtle difference between the wording last time and this time.
Okay. I do like this sort of punishment for Bacon, though, that most of your bits are built around hurting him.
Speaking of Bacon, who's Bacon?
Hey, Dan. I also like that instead of just not saying what the podcast is about, you've now extended the amount of time that sounds exactly the same. Uh-huh. So it's it actually is like the opposite of what we need that little space to do.
Yeah. So what do you feel like? What do you feel like you've learned from this experience of you telling me what I need to do?
When did you turn into like Pacino on set?
Anyway, the point is, this is Quick Question with Soren and Daniel. As always, we are Quick Question, and our fans prefer to be called, I'm excited about this one, the Chronicles of Narnia's O'Brien, the Snitch, and the Sordro. So here's the thing about this.
You didn't even give it room. You already have a disclaimer.
Because Sordrobe could be Soren, like Sordrobe, or Michael Schroer, Sroerdrobe. So you guys have the opportunity to decide between the two of you
which one is the snitch
and which one is the Sordrobe.
Which one of us deserves stitches?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll hash that out, I'm sure, over time.
You don't want to do it right now?
You didn't even, like, Narnia, you didn't even make an effort at.
Nah.
You just, that was your context, so then you could get into the good stuff.
Can I ask a question? I think I have truthfully been missing the bit in these. I thought we were making C sounds into Q sounds.
I mean, that's where the origination, but there's an evolution to the jokes, Bacon. Now it's moved on to, like, you can have quest in there anywhere that you can put it, or maybe even like a query or answer, like, so you think you
like
can answer.
Yeah, listen, we've been doing this for like 20 episodes
months.
And it feels like a fucking lifetime.
Yeah, I do. It has felt like it's made my life longer, which I'm thankful for.
At any rate, we like to call out one review every week to read on air, and Bacon told me to read this one. It was titled Wish.
All right. Good. Well, elaborate. Oh, cool. Okay.
It's titled Wish I Found This Earlier. I loved all the work they did at Cracked and forgot until I heard Dan on Small Beans and he wouldn't say what podcast he was doing. After some looking on Spotify and iTunes, I finally found it and binged the whole series. Amazing stuff from creative guys. Hope to see it continue for a while.
You went on Daily Zeitgeist and wouldn't tell them what your podcast was called?
No, I went on Small Beans and wouldn't tell them what my podcast was called.
What? To what end? Wait, why?
I don't know. I don't like being advertised to. And I feel like anytime someone promotes their podcast, they're advertising to someone. So I feel like if you like my voice, which seems insane, and you want to hear more of it, which is unhealthy, you can do that, but I'm not going to give you the tools. You just you go and you Google it yourself.
This is a good lesson, Bacon. When we finally do get ads on here, I want to read all of them.
This is before we get into the show proper. I had a real quick question, Soren. Quick question.
Go ahead.
What are you looking at right now? What is your surroundings while you're doing this podcast? I want to paint a picture for the audience.
Oh, okay. This isn't for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Bacon's got an extra room in his house that if I was to describe it, I would call it auxiliary. It's nothing on the walls. There is a big TV in here, but it looks like maybe it's outdated by a decade. And then there's just stacks of other stuff. There's a stack of other TVs. And mm-hmm. then, like, books that maybe he hasn't read in a while because they're all dusty.
I'm sorry, stack of other TVs?
Well, there's just, like, a pallet of other TVs over in a corner, I think. I can't tell. Maybe there might be an ant behind one of them. Well, I think maybe he's somebody who... He used to have TVs in every room, and then Mona... This is what I'm just assuming. I'm speculating. Mona was like, you don't need a TV in the bedroom. You don't need a TV. You need one TV room. And Bacon was like, yeah, that makes sense. there's a lot of books. There's golf clubs in here, a skateboard, some Lego men, Oculus Rift, I think.
Has he figured out what to do with all of his records?
Oh, shit. I don't even... They're not even here.
Living room. Oh. They're displayed in the living room.
Oh, okay.
Oh, there's also a lot of art just stacked on the floor.
This room is... I was told explicitly that anything that wasn't up to snuff for the apartment, I had to go in this room. Nice. So this is basically all of my possessions that I have like emotional connection to.
Yeah,
that
so
are unattractive.
I'll tell you, there's a coffee table in here and a couch that are completely unusable, like the most impractical things. It takes up the majority of the room, and we can't, like, we're stuffed into a corner because they're not usable.
In one of the episodes, you can hear Soren sit on the couch, and the legs break off the couch. And
yeah, is it a couch that the legs are gone? It sits on the floor, but still is at a weird angle. And then there's a coffee table that doesn't, you can't, like, put your legs under it or anything. It's just a big, like, it's like a coffin for a 12-year-old, is what it looks like. This a mausoleum answers- coffin.
It's so much better than I anticipated. Well, I'm not looking at anything. I asked that question because I thought I was going to have the better answer, but I think I don't. Because the thing that I'm looking at, I set up my microphone and computer at my window in my living room, and it faces a building across an alleyway from me, and I've been so distracted because the last like 15 or 20 minutes or so, there's been the person directly across from me has been, I'll say it, a very handsome man. He's been
a very handsome man.
And he's very ripped, just like a ripped shirtless man who has been trying on a series of scarves. And I don't know what to do about this information because he's like, bouncing side to side. I don't know if he's doing this for me or if he's just like looking at his reflection in his own window to see how he looks in these different scarves. But it's like, it's definitely a show for someone.
He's doing a shirtless scarf pageant?
Like runway thing. Yeah, pageant.
That's amazing. I mean, I even like when I try to comb my wildest dreams of what that could be, I still don't know.
No, you don't. I didn't expect to see this. No one ever expected to see this.
I really hope
it seems like he's doing well, but it's still it's a lot.
What's his apartment like?
You know, it's I can only see a little bit of it. His kitchen seems kind of messy. There's something hung up in his living room area. He hasn't
done... Well, not a mirror.
I can say that he hasn't done any of his own lighting. It's all whatever was in the apartment when he got it. Yeah. It's like ceiling lights.
Oh, boy.
Which, come on, buddy. It's 2019.
Well, he spent all his money on gym membership.
Spent all his money on gym membership and fucking scarves, even though it's 90 degrees in New York right now.
Well, he's a step ahead. He's ready for the autumnal season. Oh, that's amazing.
Anyway, let's get right into the show, which is about nothing. I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
Soren, there's an article I sent you. There's a great article on Transom that I sent you from Tim Howard. Did you read it?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, Tim Howard is Reply All's executive producer. Reply All is a podcast that I know that we both love. It's way better than this one. And the article is about working on a story, coming to a dead end, and instead of bailing on it completely, having the presence of mind to pivot and shift and change what the story ends up being about. It featured a quote that I love about what happens when a story falls apart. And this is the quote. "That's when you kill a story. And really, you usually should. But let me make an argument for the time when it makes sense to hang on a little longer in the wreckage of your plans." I love that quote. And it really resonated with me as a writer who's chased a lot of dead ends and has pivoted from those dead ends. And I was just curious if you had ever experienced that, where you've got an idea for a thing and you're working on it, you're digging into it, and then it falls apart. But for whatever reason, you live in the wreckage of it and spin it into a new story. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah, I feel like that happens all the time. Have you ever created anything where you, from the start, you ended up with a product that you were like, yeah, this is what I meant to make?
Absolutely not.
I'd say the majority of the things that I do, you have to on the fly kind of be like, okay, this is something different, but it's still kind of cool. I'll follow this. But I know what you mean. Like, there's some that take it a complete 90-degree turn, and it's a different place than you ever anticipated it could have gone. And I don't think I have that experience nearly as much as probably you, because I'm not a journalist. The only sort of pseudo-journalism I did was at Cracked, hunting a story. And there was the one time that comes to mind the most for me is that I was trying to get two scammers to talk to each other through email. I was getting a lot of those Nigerian prince emails, and I was trying to convince them. It was like such a long walk to get there. I was trying to convince them that I was a woman who had broken up with her boyfriend, and that he had access to her bank accounts. And so they had to write him on her behalf as a lawyer to be like, you need to forfeit this bank account, or you need to like give up the number to this bank account. And then when I finally got one of them to do that, a spammer, to email this guy and be like, hey, your wife, your ex-wife or your ex-girlfriend needs this bank account number, I got another spammer to be his agent or his lawyer, so that then the two would be only battling against each other. And I had like this grand design of how it would go. And you have to play that out really over a long time, because you have to keep them on the hook. If you do that immediately, they know it's a joke. But if you can, if you can put a frog in the pot before it boils, then like they'll just stay in it. And so I was trying to orchestrate this whole thing, and it just was not working at all. And so finally I did what a storyteller does. I just made it up. And I made up some of the emails at the end and fabricated a bunch of it. Like a journalist, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If there's no story, make a story.
That's right. It was going to be this just opera of like, I had so many grand designs for how this thing would go, where they were both fighting with each other as pretend lawyers over pretend people looking for a pretend bank account, and it just didn't happen.
I love that you still turned it into an article as a way of saying like, look, this was a good idea. I want you to appreciate the idea that I had.
Look where it could have gone. Do you have these?
I did. I had it with the Millard Fillmore chapter of my book, How to Fight Presidents, which anyone can buy right now. How to Fight Presidents, Defending Yourself Against the Badasses in This Country. The Millard Fillmore chapter, because every chapter of that book was based on a lot of research and then finding a narrative within the research, and then taking a person's life's work and boiling it down into a very unfair 2,000-word summary of that work. And I got to Millard Fillmore, and I read so much about him, and it was so unforgivably boring. There was nothing to say about him, and I kept looking, like, just, there are plenty of boring presidents that I can squeeze 2,000 words out of, and Millard Fillmore, I just couldn't. I was like, give me fucking anything, buddy. Give me something. Oh, you were left-handed? That might be interesting. You joined the Know-Nothing Party and tried to run again as the anti-Irish immigrant candidate? Maybe there's something there, but even that, there's not enough. I dug so much into this guy that I couldn't find anything. And I remember even found one book that was talking about how he was an underrated president and he was very interesting. And then I found out that book was satire because there's nothing good about Millard Fillmore. So at the end of the day, I just decided to make that chapter. It's a break from the rest of the book, and it's just about me, the author, being pissed off that there's nothing good about Millard Fillmore.
Yeah, that's a good direction. And,
sorry?
That's a great direction.
I don't love it, but it was like the only thing I could do was I was like, I'm trying to find something interesting. I can't. Okay, then maybe the most interesting thing about Millard Fillmore is that a person whose job it is to find something interesting about him can't find it. That's what the chapter's about. And it ended up working for the book, luckily.
Yeah.
And so I think that's just,
you still didn't, you still haven't found it even since then? Like nothing has come
up? I still
up.
Haven't found it. And I think that chapter ends with just me saying, fuck Millard Fillmore. Like me, the author, being like, fuck this guy.
Well, this podcast is brought to you by How to Fight Presidents, Defending Yourself Against the Badasses Who Ran This Country by Daniel O'Brien. You can find it at your local Barnes & Noble. Some art in there by Winston Roundtree. A really great book. You should check it out.
Very good.
Dan, I have a quick question for you.
Go ahead.
Are there people that you encounter in your everyday life who you just, they're innocuous people. They're not like, I'm not talking about Nazis or like misogynists or just rude people in general. I mean, people that are doing very innocuous things and you just hate them for it.
Are these singular people that I see every day?
No,
or
it ends up being like it's like a contagious thing where like they're all doing something similar. I'll give you some examples of the ones that I hate the most.
Please.
I can't stand people who take pictures or cell phone video of fireworks. There's something about it that really irks me. That people are trying to capture, first of all, this very ephemeral thing that you're just supposed to enjoy in the moment. But I don't want to sound too stodgy and old man-ish. I think it's also silly because it's the middle of the night. Those photos have never once turned out good. If you're on a cell phone, I guess there's people who take real professional photos of fireworks, and maybe those look great, but I've never seen
No one has ever taken a good picture of a firework in the history of humankind.
And so what are they, and who's that for also? Like, who are you going to show that to and be like, see this? Are you going to put that, a shitty picture of a firework on Instagram? Whose brand is that?
Bacon's.
Well, Bacon, do you do this?
No shot. Okay, but I do think it's like a human reaction because it's very impressive.
It's
and you're like, oh my God.
But then you have that disconnect.
Someone's got to see this.
History will want to know what happened here. I've never seen it. Yeah, no one has ever taken a good photo of a firework. No one's taken a good video of a firework. I don't get it. And it pisses me off that people do it because I'm like, you don't even know why you're doing it. You don't know.
I understand that in the same way that I understand, like, when I've been backpacking through somewhere where I'm caught up in a moment and I want to capture how I'm feeling at the moment so I can remember it and I can share it with people. And I'll take a picture and then immediately look at the picture and be like, no, that's not it.
Yeah, the picture never gets it right.
It's the same way with fireworks where I'm just like, I'm enjoying where I'm at right now. I love the company that I'm keeping. I'm on a boat on the water watching fireworks, having the time of my life. I want to capture this. Again, take a picture, look at it. Nah, that sucks ass. That's not good.
It never looks good. Yeah, I don't get it. It's also, it ruins the experience for everyone else around you too, because you've got that bright screen now up in the sky. Yeah. And they try and get close to it with their like fully arm fully extended out. Like that's going to help.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really pissed off at those people. I also really dislike people who, when the plane lands, they clap.
Yeah, you've mentioned this before. Why?
The pilot can't hear that. Who's that for? And also, he's doing, that's his job. Like, it would be a huge disaster if he didn't do that well. Are people just happy they're not dead?
Yeah.
Well, that's silly. Planes planes take off and land all the time. It's like such a menial part of somebody's job, I feel like, that to clap for almost feels like you're patronizing them.
I would say a thing that's plane related that bothers me more than clapping when a plane lands is people who stand up as soon as the seatbelt light comes on because and this is just a signal for me. I don't like sitting when people around me are standing.
Yeah.
It makes me very uncomfortable, very upset. And I've flown enough that I know that when a plane lands and when you get the okay that you could take your seatbelts off, that doesn't mean you can leave the plane immediately. There's still going to be a bunch of time when they attach that fucking
jetway
big accordion wiener to the door and secure that, and then you can go out. But as soon as the seatbelt light turns off, people stand up, and then I'm just sitting there secure in the knowledge that, like, no, we can't move yet.
But now all your crotches are in my face.
And they're just, like, looming around me. And I hate that. And I just want to be like, look, just don't get up until the door opens and people start moving. Because otherwise we're just a bunch of weird sardines in different stages of anxiety. So just, like, keep waiting. I know the sign came on that said you could take your seatbelt off, but you can't affect the change anymore by standing. So please cool it. And I hate you.
Yeah. That's that feeling, that like modicum of control they get out of it, of like, well, at least this is my own. This is of my own doing. I can now prepare this part. I stand. Right. I'm with you. I really hate it when they stand.
I similarly hate when they, when you're boarding a plane and the boarding group hasn't been called, but they people who decide, like, well, they called boarding group one, but I'm boarding group four, but I still want to, like, clump up near the line. Even though if I'm not technically online right now, I want to just, like, hang out near it.
Yeah, like, there's the chance that the woman calling him is going to be like, she's going to go from boarding zone one to all of a sudden be like, and four.
Yeah, and you smart guys in boarding group four who decided to show up early. You guys, you can get on now. That really bothers me. We're just like, we have a system. Just follow the system.
Yeah. You're right. That one really drives me crazy. They don't recognize that their bodies are a physical presence that's in the way of everybody else.
Yeah.
It just feels very inconsiderate. I used to be one of the people that jumped up as soon as the plane, the sign went off. I was just like, and now I'm up. Now things are different. I know I have to wait a little bit longer, but now we're at a new level now. This is the part where I stand. But I really hate it, especially now that I have a kid, because he gets really excited and then, like, he thinks we're going and we're like, no, just stay calm. And then, like, he starts to get very anxious and weird and you can't calm him down when everybody's up and just silent. but I don't know if you noticed, Dan, I know that about you. And when I put you in the compliment corner, that's something I really try to emulate, is that you're lower than I am, kind of at crotch level.
Uh-huh. That's fair.
Okay. Do you have other ones that you hate?
It's also, I'm finding now as I think about it, it's also about spatial awareness. It's about, like, walking down a hallway or walking down, like, apartment corridors, and people who seem to take up what feels like the entire horizon.
Yeah.
Available to me, just like all of the entire width of human sight somehow can be consumed by two people with linked arms. That really bothers me when I'm walking down the street or walking down a hallway and there's just these people who are walking very slowly and taking up a lot of physical real estate. That bothers me.
That's
like anything that implies that you are not aware that there's a whole world around you will always upset me.
Yes, that infuriates me. I get people who are just inconsiderate because they're not focused on the world around them really piss me off, because I've spent so much time being focused on that. Another one that I really genuinely hate, that's just a little bit different, is the people who say, I've been writing since before I could walk, or like, I've been playing piano. I wanted to play piano since before I could talk. Like the ones who talk about how they've been doing this one hobby since they were babies, like somehow that makes them good at it. That drives me up the wall.
Really? Do you encounter that a lot?
Yeah. Well, I'm on X Factor or shows like that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or anytime there's somebody who... So I meet occasionally with people who are... they're in college or whatever, and they're interested in the field that I work in. And that's a lot of times that's how they start. They're like, I love writing.
Just for our listeners, Soren, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he will go to a different college from like 6 to 2 a.m. and just sort of skulk around looking for people.
Looking for talent.
This is what you're talking about. This is when you find these people.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to recognize me because I wear a hat and glasses.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, you might. What I do is I lick my lips also.
Yeah.
That's just, it's the season. They get really chapped mm-hmm. this time of year. But yeah, it's, I'm just looking for talent.
Yeah.
Scouting. yeah, I occasionally will meet with people and when people want to prove to you how much something means to them or how good they might be at it, they're like, oh man, it's what I've wanted to be my entire life. Even before I could walk, I was doing this. And you're like, motherfucker, none of that old shit matters.
Like, right.
People, that doesn't mean that you're good at it or that you deserve to do it.
Right. You can't really convince another person about your qualifications. You can just display it. You know, you can't say, I've been writing forever and that's why I'm good. You can't say, I've been thinking about designing buildings and that's why I'm a good architect. Just show me a piece of writing or show me a building, I guess, to continue that metaphor.
A blueprint, let's say.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's like this, that there's something that people automatically ascribe working on something for a long time to it naturally being good. And you find that right. everywhere where somebody that's when you give anybody some criticism on something, if it's very candid and you're not sugarcoating it, a lot of times the response you'll get from people is like, do you have any idea how long I worked on this? And it's like those two things are not related. Sure. I mean, working yeah. on something and thinking it through all the way is important, but how long you spend on something and how good it is, those things are not synonymous ever.
Yeah. I mean, not ever.
It helps. I'll say that. Yeah. I'll say that it does help. But if already something is bad and then they're like, you know how long I've worked on it, that doesn't sway me. I'm not like, oh shit. Oh, maybe right. it is good.
If I want to criticize something that I read that is submitted to me by someone who wants criticism, it will not be changed based on how long they worked on it.
Right. In fact, I think it only hurts if you tell them. If they're like, listen, this is something that's been my passion project for the last 5 years. I'm like, no, that you're not selling it the right way.
Yeah. Bacon, what are your thoughts on this?
I was actually thinking that sometimes it's the opposite. Like I played guitar since I was 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last 6 years, I don't really play that much guitar. And so the more I age, it sounds more impressive by that virtue. Cause I've been like, now I've been playing guitar for like 20 years, but I've gotten worse in the last 6 years. So,
there's a fall off here.
Yeah. So it's like, it creates a bigger expectation and a worse result now.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I guess if there was a 6-year-old who was out there writing like some James Joyce or some shit, I'd be like, yeah, that is impressive. But when people say I've been writing since I could hold a pencil in my hand, I've been telling stories. And you're like, I bet those stories sucked.
Speaking of writing and James Joyce and stories, Soren, I got a quick question for you.
Shoot.
What are the books that you read in high school that were assigned to you from high school? Do you remember?
Yeah. Scarlet Letter.
Mm-hmm.
The Day No Pigs Would Die. Do you know that one?
Oh, I've never even heard of that.
Okay. That's a very agrarian book. I'll tell you about it. I have some very sad stories about that book. We read a book called All Over But the Shoutin'. Have you ever read that?
No.
Makes
what the
me
fuck?
Makes me want to holler. No. Oh, wait. This might be a good time to explain that I went to school in a barn.
Yeah, it's important that everyone knows that Soren went to school in a barn in the past.
I genuinely went to school in a barn. We read Into the Wild.
Okay.
So there's one.
Yeah.
Canterbury Tales. We read the Bible.
Uh-huh. I know it.
Let's see. Is there one in particular that you're looking for?
No, I was going to just like ask about high school literature broadly, but it seems like we are not working from the same baseline frame of reference.
Yeah, so it was...
To do that.
Just to give you some context, I went to a small school that was very outdoor-oriented. A lot of the curriculum was built around... like when we read Into the Wild... No, when we read Jack London's To Build a Fire, we didn't do it in a classroom. We didn't know what we were expecting. We got to the class, the teacher put us on a bus, and we went up to this area called Spring Gulch, which is a cross-country ski area, just covered in snow. And we all sat out in the woods for a little while in the snow, not prepared for that at all, and read To Build a Fire out there, because he was like, this is what it's like. And so it was all, everything had that element to it. We were never just like reading a story for the, giving yourself that arsenal of like how to understand and dissect a story. It was more like, how do you contextualize this within the greater context of nature?
And then did you build a fire as part of your curriculum?
No, he just wanted us to give us the sense, because that guy only walks 5 miles, I think, in the short story. Are you familiar with it?
No.
Okay, To Build a Fire is a story about a guy who, I can't remember why he can't stay in his cabin, but there's a blizzard, he needs to get into town or something, and he knows it's only 5 miles, and so he decides to walk. And it's so brutal that he can't make it. And on the way, he knows that he, in order to survive, he has to build a fire. I think he falls in a stream at one point, and so he's getting hypothermic. He finally gets a fire going underneath a tree branch, and then the snow from the tree branch falls. It melts and falls and extinguishes the fire, and he dies. It's 5 miles. It feels like anything you could do. Anybody could do it. But in the right circumstances, or I guess what you would call the wrong circumstances, it's just never going to work for you. And so in order to actually feel that, they took us out into the snow, made us sit in a snowbank and fucking read that story.
Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah.
That is not where I thought this question was going to go at all.
Yeah. So it was a very specialized education that I would say kind of hurt me in some regards when I went away to college, that I was not prepared for actually treating knowing how to dissect a book.
Yeah, right. When you got to college, was that the first time that you were like doing close reading and
yes,
like approaching literature as like an art? I don't know.
Yeah, but like doing like a self-contained piece. Yeah. We'd never treated it like that before.
Huh. Well, we had different situations.
What was yours?
No, I was just, I've just been thinking about it a lot lately because there's an episode of another podcast that is much better than ours that is called Keep It. And
by the way, everyone should be listening to Keep It and Reply All. Like, these are great, great podcasts. Oh,
they're so good. They're so much better than
Reply All is my absolute favorite podcast of all time.
It's one of the only necessary podcasts.
And their ad reads, perfect.
Oh my God, they're so fun and engaging. But anyway, on Keep It, they were interviewing Gia Tolentino, who's got an amazing book right now called Trick Mirror. Everyone should check it out, Trick Mirror. And she was talking about the books that she read in high school, and it made me think about the books that I read in high school. And as someone who reads lots of books and loves lots of books, I think it's insane that in my high school experience, at least, the de facto assumption was, we are giving you this book to read and the book is good. Like every single thing that we read in high school, the starting place was, by the way, this is good.
Yeah.
Chaucer is good. Right. Catch 22 is good. Grapes of Wrath is good. That Animal Farm is good. Crime and Punishment is good. Catcher in the Rye is good.
Camus Scarlet is good. Letter is good. Yeah.
And they didn't allow the idea that a reader could say, hey, I read this whole fucking Chaucer thing and I think it sucks ass in a pretty major way. That's not allowed. If you have that opinion, you're wrong. And I think that's just like an insane way that literature curriculum is taught across America. But it turns out it's not that way across America, because you read books about fucking dying in the woods or whatever.
No, I know what you're saying. I think every single thing that we did read was with that assumption. Like, we wouldn't give you shit. We're right. not going to train you to read and write shit. Like, we'll show you the very best that literature has to offer. And that was always right. the precedent, yeah, going into it. And having the opinion that this just isn't very good or has a lot of holes in it, that was, you're right, that's not something that was allowed. And even in college, that wasn't allowed.
Now I'm allowed to say, like, hey, I think Canterbury Tales kind of sucks ass. But at the time reading it, if I expressed even like an articulate version of that opinion, I fail the test.
Yeah, I think I understand it, though. It's because that's sort of a non-starter with anything. Having just a criticism of it, of how it's created, doesn't teach you the actual lessons they're trying to teach you about the tools of that the author is employing. You know, like they're showing you, look, on a very basic level, this is how a metaphor is helpful. This is how you foreshadow early on in a story. This is how you tie a story together and you give arcs to your characters and create archetypes for each one of them. And if your starting point is, well, this book sucks, then it doesn't really advance the conversation. Same, I think, like when we adjust pop culture, I know a lot of pop culture is bad. But if I continue to look at it over and over again, I can come up with a reason why Con Air might be good.
Right.
So I get it, I guess. But yeah, it is. It does seem like, I think maybe it's also changing too. I think that that's a pretty, in college, it seems like in colleges, you're allowed to now say, no, Mark Twain is problematic. Here's why this book is not, is bad for anyone who's not a white guy reading it.
Right. I'm actually curious what, kids are reading in school today. Not so curious that I want anyone to tell me on Twitter what they are.
Email it
reading.
To us. The QQ.
Oh my God. Email it. Yes.
Perfect spot for it. It'll live there forever. I promise you.
Load it up. Okay. It's time to wrap up. I'm going to close things out with all of our social media accounts to give you guys places to follow us. But while I'm doing that, I just wanted to bring something up. Todd Phillips, writer-director behind the Hangover trilogy and also that War Dogs movie that everyone saw, and the helmer of the upcoming Joker movie, had this to say on the subject of why he moved from comedies to the very serious Joker movie. Quote, "Go try to be funny nowadays with this woke culture. There were articles written about why comedies don't work anymore. I'll tell you why. Because all the fucking funny guys are like, fuck this shit. Because I don't want to offend you. It's hard to argue with 30 million people on Twitter. You just can't do it, right? So you just go, I'm out." And I believe when he said that, which is to say when he said that woke culture is ruining comedy, so that's why he's quitting it, you, Soren, said, same. Care to expand on that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I know that I happen to work on a comedy show, but every single day I walk in there and I think about how I can fuck over my audience and really stick it to them, because that's the only way people grow. You hurt them, right? You hurt them, you abuse them, and that's how they grow. And that's what comedy is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be funny. If you're laughing, it means you don't get it. It's supposed to hurt inside of you. And then you're supposed to say at the end, thank you very much for that pain. I'm a bigger, better person because of it. And if they're not doing that, then they don't get it. So people who think that comedy is about laughing, what is this, a kid's cartoon? We watch an anvil fall on a coyote? That's not what we're doing on here on stage. We're teaching lessons about the world. This is the school of hard knocks, my friend. And you're going to get knocked. Speaking of which, Knocked Up, excellent movie. Perfect example. Like, you're teaching people. If you're teaching people that women, not so great unless they're hot, in which case they better be insecure. And if even if they that you can get that window open and you can finally like get them pregnant, hang on to that.
You can find Soren on Twitter at Soren_LTD. You could find me at DLB_INC. You could find our CFO Bacon at Make Me Bacon, Please. You can email the show at QQ with Soren and Daniel @gmail.com. You could find the show on Twitter at @QQ_SorenandDan or on Instagram @QQ_with_Soren_and_Daniel. You can find and hire our amazing engineer, editor, producer, Vincent at siliconbeachpodcasts.com. We also have a Patreon that you could probably fucking find somewhere. And that's it. That's the show.
It's good to talk to you, Dan.
Yeah, this was nice. I'm glad I got to give you that space at the end to say how you really feel.
Really freeing. I feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think Bill Burr will call me?
I think you've got there's a podcast lineup in your future that is you and Bill Burr and Joe Rogan and Adam Carolla. I think I can see that for you, and I love that for you.
Yeah, I see it now. It's just the top, just the tour is called Women Aren't Funny.
So the hashtag triggered tour.
All right, bye.